Testament, 1 Kings chapter 20. I want to take your mind as well as your eyes back to this period of Old Testament history to see if there's a lesson that we can gain from the story that is told here, or actually a story within a story. To kind of set the context, you'll remember this period of Israel's history that we normally refer to as the divided kingdom. You remember the descendants of Abraham had formed a nation by the fulfillment of God's promise to Abraham. And that nation became known as Israel. And they settled in this promised land. And for a great period of time, they were ruled over by judges, when in reality, they were being ruled over by God. God was their king. But yet at times, God was not really their king, because a king's only a king when you submit to him. And Israel rebelled, and one of their rebellions is when they asked for a king of their own. And so God relented and gave them a king. And we move into a period that we sometimes refer to as the United Kingdom, when Israel was ruled over by four different kings. Saul, David, Solomon, and for a brief time, Rehoboam was their king of this United Kingdom. But because of their continued rebellion and wickedness, God took the kingdom away from Rehoboam, Solomon's son, and tore it in two. And now we have this period of the divided kingdom. We have the two tribes of Judah in the south, the 10 tribes of Israel in the north, and they were both continuing in their rebellion to God. Israel in the north, more so. You'll remember from your study of Old Testament histories that there really wasn't a good king in all of this northern divided tribe of Israel. Not a good one in the bunch, but of all the bad ones, Ahab was maybe the worst. We find ourselves during the reign of Ahab in the divided kingdom in 1 Kings chapter 20. Because of their wickedness and their straying away from God, from time to time, God would send a pest, a neighboring country or a neighboring army to come and to oppress them or defeat them to show that God was trying to correct them. But other times, God would let them win those battles as a way of showing that if they were obedient, God would be with them. In the context of 1 Kings chapter 20, Ahab is the king of the divided kingdom of Israel. Ben-Hadad is the king of Syria. And Ben-Hadad issues a threat against Israel and says that unless you pay me what I want you to pay me, I'm going to come down there and destroy you. We have to give Ahab some credit, as wicked as he was. His retort here was pretty good. He said, "Let not him who puts on the armor boast like him who takes off the armor." And so Ben-Hadad was going to come against Israel, but God gave Israel the victory to show that he was with them and would be with them if they would only turn and be obedient to him. So Ben-Hadad and his army were defeated. This battle took place in the hills. And so Ben-Hadad, the king of Syria, came to the incorrect conclusion that the God of Israel was a God of the hills. And so next time when we fight them, we'll fight them in the valley. And we'll be able to beat them there. But God was going to show Ben-Hadad and all of Israel that he wasn't just a God of the hills, but he was also a God in the valley. And so Ben-Hadad and the nation of Syria was defeated again. Ben-Hadad ran away. And he tore his clothes to make himself look more pitiful, and he goes into Ahab and kind of pleads his case. And Ahab calls him brother and takes him in and kind of becomes a friend of his. When what really he should have done was, in his defeat of Ben-Hadad in Syria, he should have destroyed, he should have killed Ben-Hadad. But Ahab doesn't. And so God, much like he did to David when David sinned in the situation with Bathsheba, God sends a prophet. And as he did to David, to Ahab, he's not going to just directly condemn him. He's going to have that prophet, kind of like Nathan did, tell a story. and tell a story that will really condemn the king. I want us to notice that story in 1 Kings chapter 20. And in verse 35 it begins. Now a certain man of the sons of the prophets said to his neighbor, "By the word of the Lord, strike me, please." The man refused to strike him. Then he said to him, "Because you've not obeyed the voice of the Lord, surely as soon as you depart from me, a lion shall kill you." And as soon as he left him, a lion found him and killed him. And he found another man and said, "Strike me, please." So the man struck him, inflicting a wound. Then the prophet departed and waited for the king by the road and disguised himself with a bandage over his eyes. Do we get the scene of what's taking place here? He's had somebody beat him up so he looked like he's been in the battle, and he disguises himself like he's been in the battle, puts a bandage over his wounds, his supposed wounds. And now it says in verse 39, "Now as the king passed by, he," that is this servant disguised, "cried out to the king and said, 'Your servant went out into the midst of the battle, and there a man came over and brought a man to me and said, guard this man. If by any means he is missing, your life shall be for his life, or else you shall pay a talent of silver. And while your servant was busy here and there, he was gone.' And the king of Israel said to him, 'So shall your judgment be. You yourself have decided it.' Then he hastened to take the bandage away from his eyes, and the king of Israel recognized him as one of the prophets. And he said to him, 'Thus says the Lord, because you have let slip out of your hand a man whom I appointed to utter destruction, therefore your life shall go for his life, and your people for his people.' So the king of Israel went to his house sullen and displeased and came to Samaria." Kind of like Nathan did when he told David that story of the lamb. This prophet kind of sets up the king, doesn't he? By having him condemn himself, by telling this story about a man that he was supposedly to be guarding in the midst of battle. And he says that the instruction was, guard this man. But he says, "You know, I kind of got busy here and there and turned around and he was gone." What a powerful immediate application to Ahab. Ahab had been given an instruction what to do to Ben-Hadad, and he didn't do it, and so he was going to be condemned. I want to take this story that this prophet told in condemning Ahab and see if it maybe will condemn us. When he says that he had been given instructions to guard this man, when we think about that admonition or that instructions, there are certain things or certain people that we have been instructed to guard. Turn with me now in the New Testament as we begin to make some applications, hopefully, from this story, that there are certain people that we are been given to guard, certain people that we've been entrusted with. And will we be like this prophet in his imaginary story, or like Ahab, and fail in our responsibility? If so, we too will be condemned. One of the people that we've been entrusted with is ourselves. We've been entrusted with ourselves. Look in the book of Acts chapter 2. Now, that day of Pentecost, when the gospel was preached there, one of the things that Peter and the rest of these apostles did as they preached to this audience is he condemned them. Condemned them specifically for their role in the death of Jesus Christ. And he says, I want to notice the text in Acts chapter 2, in verse 40 it says, "And with many other words he testified and exhorted them, saying, 'Be saved from this perverse generation.'" I think it's the old King James. One translation says, "Save yourselves from this perverse generation." Be saved from this perverse generation. Whatever translation you read, the emphasis there is that the responsibility was upon them. Here is the message. The message that Paul would later call the power of God to salvation. But Peter and these apostles were saying, you have to respond to it. You be saved. You save yourself. Now we know that in the most direct and literal sense, that's not possible for us to save ourselves. That's why Jesus had to come. That's why He had to give His life. That's why the gospel had to be told and written so that God could save us. But we know what Peter means. We know what these apostles mean when they say, be saved or save yourself. They're saying, you respond. God has laid forth the gospel. He has given this gift, but yet it is still required for us to respond to it. It's still required for us to believe in it and to obey it. And therefore, the responsibility is ours. We have been given the responsibility to guard ourselves. God has entrusted us. Do we ever think about it this way? God has entrusted us with a soul, with a spirit that was made in His own image. We make the point so many times that we're made in the image of God, and that doesn't mean that God looks like us physically. But we look like God spiritually. We have a spirit in us that was patterned after His spirit. God has entrusted us with that gift, with a spirit modeled after His. We are or can become partakers of the divine nature. And God has not only gifted us with that, but He has placed upon us the responsibility to entrust us that we guard that. Look what Paul said in the book of Philippians chapter 2. As he used similar language. Philippians chapter 2, Paul writes letter to this congregation that meant so much to him, that he'd spent so much time with. But now he's in prison. And probably about to die. What are these Christians going to do without him? Without his instruction, without his constant encouragement, without his constant nagging them to obey and do what is right? The answer is in Philippians 2, verse 12. Therefore, my beloved, as you've always obeyed, not as in my presence only, but now much more in my absence, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. Work out your own salvation. Again, this cannot mean a dependence, an independence from God. He is not saying, it's yours, pull yourself up by your own bootstraps, you don't need God, you don't need the gospel. That's not what Paul is saying. But what Paul is saying is, it's up to you. I'm away from you now. You can't depend upon old Apostle Paul. In fact, I'm about to die and you sure won't be able to depend on me. It's up to you. You accept the responsibility, Philippian brethren, he says. You accept the responsibility for your soul's salvation. You work out your own salvation. Don't always be looking to Paul for your help and your guidance. You accept that responsibility. Guard this man. God has given us all an individual responsibility. Now, while we understand that we have utter dependence upon God, while we understand that we have an utter dependence upon the Scriptures and therefore the apostles and those inspired men that wrote it, and that while we understand that we have an interdependence with one another that we've been put together with in a local church, that ultimately it comes down to me. I have to make that decision. Oh yes, it'll be God who washes away my sins. It'll be through the power of the gospel. But I have some responsibility myself. God has entrusted me with a soul and a spirit made in His own image, and He has said, it is now yours. God never compels us in the sense of forcing us to obey Him. It's simply an invitation. Will you respond to that invitation? It is yours. Guard this man. But it goes much further than that. God has given us others to whom we are to guard, in a sense. Our neighbors. Now, we don't have the same responsibility toward our neighbors that we have toward ourselves, because we can make ourselves conform and believe and obey, but we can't make somebody else. But we still have a responsibility. Look at that responsibility in a phrase in the book of Mark, chapter 12. Some of the most famous words that Jesus spoke are in Mark chapter 12, when Jesus gives two commandments. Two, what we might call, that he called, two really big commandments. We know the first, don't we? Love the Lord thy God. But he says the second one in Mark chapter 12, verse 31, the second one, which he says in another place, is real close to the first one. Mark 12, verse 31, he says, and the second like it is this, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. There is no other commandment greater than these. Love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, soul, and mind, and love thy neighbor as thyself. We know from other places that some in Jesus' day had sought to excuse themselves from that commandment by saying, okay, I'll love my neighbor, but let me define who my neighbor is. Jesus, remember, told the story of the Good Samaritan to dispel that mistaken notion by basically saying, everybody's your neighbor. Even if you're minding your own business and walking down the road and here's a fellow you've never even seen before, maybe even from another country who's been beaten and left for dead, he is your neighbor. Everybody is my neighbor. That changes the commandment, doesn't it? Drastically. Love thy neighbor as thyself. The responsibility has been placed upon us for our fellow man. Now, not again in the complete sense that we're responsible for our own salvation, but we are responsible to some degree for our neighbors. Love thy neighbor. We could talk all morning about the application to that, but I want to limit it to this morning to just one application, and that is with the gospel. We say it constantly, we live in the midst of a dying world. Dying not because we're just dying physically, but more importantly, because this world is lost. They are dying or already dead spiritually. We have the responsibility to guard them in the sense that we have the knowledge of the truth. We are to share that knowledge. Isn't that a fulfillment of loving our neighbor? Oh, it means if they've been beaten and left for dead that we need to take care of their wounds and put them in a hotel and make sure they're taken care of like the Good Samaritan. But isn't a greater fulfillment of that command that if I have something more powerful than an oil or an ointment to put on their wounds, more powerful than money that would assist them, that I have the gospel, which is, again, the power of God to salvation. And if I truly love my neighbors, I'm going to share that gospel with them. If not, can it truly be said that I love my neighbor? Can it truly be said I'm fulfilling the commandment, the second most important commandment Jesus said there is, love thy neighbor as thyself? Can it really be said that I love them if I selfishly hoard the gospel and don't share it with them? Guard this man. Well, the Bible speaks of another to whom I have a tremendous amount of responsibility. That is my wife, or maybe your husband. We are commanded, Ephesians 5, Titus chapter 2, tells husbands to love your wives. Wives, love your husbands. There's a responsibility there. That there is someone else that we have been entrusted with, that we are to guard. Look at it in this very special sense. Look over in the book of 1 Peter. 1 Peter chapter 3. When we talk about the relationship of husbands and wives, so many times we speak of it in material or in physical terms. And there are those obligations, and there are many. But let's never forget the most important obligation that we have toward our spouse, which is the same important obligation that we have toward our neighbor. 1 Peter chapter 3, look at verse 7 here. He says, likewise, you husbands, dwell with them, that is your wives, you husbands, dwell with your wives with understanding, giving honor to the wife as to the weaker vessel, as being heirs together of the grace of life, that your prayers may not be hindered. Peter emphasizes here surely the most important part of marriage, as it ought to be, that we are heirs together of the grace of life. Yes, I have fulfillment, material and physical obligations that must be fulfilled in the marital relationship. But the greatest one that I can ever fulfill is helping my mate get to heaven. Of making sure that we are heirs together of the grace of life. Because if we get everything else right in our marriage and we miss this, we have been a failure as a husband. We've been a failure as a wife. Now again, we made that first point. It's going to be ultimately up to them to obey the gospel. And you can't make somebody do anything. But you need to be doing all that you can to influence positively those close to you. And that includes someone else that we've been entrusted to guard. And that is our children. The psalmist says that children are a gift from God. That's true. But again, they are not just a gift, but they are a gift from God. God has entrusted us. As parents, God has entrusted us with one of His own creatures. That's humbling to think of in that way, isn't it? And no wonder the Apostle Paul then admonishes us in Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 4 to bring them up, to raise them up in the nurture and the admonition of the Lord. Again, we could emphasize all the things of a material and physical nature that we do for our children. But this morning, let's emphasize the spiritual. The greatest responsibility we have as parents is not to clothe them, is not to feed them, is not to protect them. The greatest obligation we have is to bring them up in the nurture and the admonition. Some translations say the training and the discipline of the Lord. How are we doing? How are we doing with those with whom we've been entrusted? The prophet in his imaginary story said, "I did a terrible job." Somebody said, "Guard this man," and I lost him. He was really talking about Ahab, who did a terrible job. God had given him a responsibility. God had given him a job to do, and he failed utterly in it. How are we doing? God said, "Guard this man. Work out your own salvation in fear and trembling. Love thy neighbor as thyself. Love your husband. Love your wife. Bring up your children in the nurture and admonition of the Lord." In essence, God has said, "Guard this man." How are you doing? Any better than Ahab? You remember in the prophet's story, he went on to say, he was given the instructions, guard this man, but his excuse was, which remember was an imaginary excuse in this imaginary story, he says, "I was given the instructions to guard this man, and while I was busy, here and there." That's our excuse, isn't it? That's my excuse why I'm not doing what I need to do in my own life to work out my own salvation. That's surely my excuse while I'm not preaching the gospel to my neighbor. And even closer to home, that's why I'm not the encouragement, the edification to my spouse that I ought to be. Or why I'm not raising my children in the nurture and admonition of the Lord is because I'm just too busy. 2 points in this regard. We understand that we're often busy with many things here and there. Someone has said of our 21st century American society that we are busier than we've ever been, doing less than we've ever done. That's an indictment on us, isn't it? We're so busy doing stuff that really just doesn't matter. I remember there was a time in school when I particularly did well on an assignment. I remember that because it so rarely happened. But I did really good. I needed a good grade in this class. I was kind of slipping, and so I made sure I buckled down and studied, and I did real good on this assignment. In fact, the teacher said I got every question right. But then she went on to say, "But you did the wrong assignment." Will God say that of us in the judgment? "Oh, you are the best employee that company ever saw. You are the best athlete that sport ever saw." And in whatever pursuits you have, fill in the blank. But God will say, "The only problem is that wasn't your assignment. Your assignment was what the wise man said, fear God and keep His commandments. That's the whole duty of man." We may excel and may be so busy at pursuits, and we may be tremendously successful at them. But in the final estimation, we'll find out we did great, but we did the wrong work. What are your priorities? Is it your soul's salvation? Is it loving your neighbor by teaching them the gospel? Is it loving your spouse by making sure you're joint heirs of the grace of life? Is it raising your children in the nurture and admonition of the Lord? Or are you just busy here and there? I find it interesting that thousands of years ago, the prophet in his story used an excuse that's still just as modern as if it was spoken today. How many times have you said, in this past week, I would do that, but I'm too busy? What we're really saying is, that's not a priority to me. We all have the same amount of time. Someone else is doing it, you could do it. When we say we're too busy, what we're really saying is, that's not a priority. There is something to you this week. This next week may be busy. You may look at your schedule and calendar and see it is absolutely slap full. But there's at least one thing that you would make time for. There's at least one thing that you would clear your schedule for. It might be tickets to next weekend's games. Football season has started. Many of us, it doesn't matter how busy we were, if somebody gave us free tickets and free transportation to that game, would you say, I'm too busy? Or would you say, oh, I had a lot to do, but not anymore? See, when we say we're too busy, we're really just admitting what our priorities are. I was busy here and there. And then he finally said, the prophet did in his story, in verse 40 of 1 Kings. I was given the instructions to guard this man, and while I was busy here or there, he was gone. That may be true of ourselves. This life is all you get. And when it's gone, there'll be no second chance. You may stay on the stand on the day of judgment and utter the same words of this futile words of this prophet. And I was busy here and there, and my life was gone. It could be said of your neighbors. Will that neighbor move away? And you realize, you know, I never took the time. Or as the song we sometimes sing, will that neighbor pass? And you'll see him on the judgment day and he'll say, you never mentioned him to me. What about your spouse? Some husbands and wives don't find out until they're sitting in a divorce court just how important that spouse was to them. Don't get busy here and there and found out that they're gone. Too many of a parent has realized after their children have left home and are now living the life that they were raised to live, that maybe I should have taken more time. Maybe I shouldn't have been quite as busy and should have spent a little bit more time raising them in the nurture and the admonition of the Lord. Oh, I was busy here and there, and he was gone. Let's redouble our efforts to make and to take advantage of the opportunities that God has given us. The Apostle Paul said, buying up the opportunities, redeeming the time, because the days are evil. The days are evil. That clock is clicking fast. The sands are pouring through the hourglass. And there'll come a time in which you'll look up and say, it's gone. Why not take advantage of the opportunities that you have now? Because it may be the only opportunity that you have. Maybe you need to respond to the gospel this morning. Don't be busy here and there and realize that your life is gone. Respond to the gospel this morning. If we can help you in any spiritual way, whether it's initial obedience to the gospel or in your return to Christ, why not let it be known right now while we stand and while we sing? Voice I hear, swelling the tones of
the dark house we